ruffled beat, a Ray Lynch's cloud, but clouds below your knees signals 8 p.m. when Thursday, and time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, and it's right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I'm your host, Mary Edgerton, along with an ensemble of truly gifted hosts. Hank Rubicek, our show's founder, Greg Audell, appearing with Floyd the Wonder Dog, and Warren Holloman, our master of wellness. These guys are not only gifted hosts, they are also great storytellers. And more about that during our announcements tonight. Rounding out our team is our chief production engineer and media director, Tatiana Gago. Together with our guest storytellers that we bring on the show every week, we celebrate the power of story. Stories take us on a journey where we begin to experience the world within the storyteller's world. Storytelling communicates more than words. It connects us as human beings because it chronicles our lives with friends and family. Last week, Eric hosted three incredible women police officers whose stories of bravery and strength were perfect to celebrate International Women's Day to kick off Women's Month, a time we celebrate the resilience and endurance of women. Tonight, we continue to celebrate Women's Month with my guest, Dr. Bora Lim, along with some prize stories to augment this special night. Bora is a medical oncologist at MD Anderson, where she treats breast cancer patients. I am happy to be one of her colleagues there. Bora grew up and received her education in South Korea, and I'm going to let her tell you a little more about that in just a moment. First, Bora, tell us in your own words what you do at MD Anderson.
Oh, hi, Mary, and everyone that was listening to the show, including hopefully my friends and family out there. Thank you for having me. I am one of the breast medical oncologists, meaning that basically I offer you a toxin that whenever you get this horrible disease called breast cancer, and I am trying to focus on especially the worst kinds of breast cancer instead of the ones that's easily treat, but that's really aggressive and really hard to treat, including something called inflammatory breast cancer.
Yes, actually, I was just looking at one of your articles today about that, and that is a very aggressive breast cancer. You know, from the moment I first met you, I have always thought that you sounded almost more like a physicist, but you're a medical doctor. Do you have a story that tells us how come you have this mixed appearance? Presentation?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a good question. So actually, the first time that you would ever see me, you may even not even notice that I am anything close to either physicist or medical doctor. A lot of people call me like a girl or Missy or whatever. But the bottom line is I really wanted to, for a long time, I wanted to be a physicist just to prove that there is a power in women that who can make a proof, that make a difference in the world by trying to figure out what's really ruling the world and the changing the world by studying the fluid physics or some of the cool engineering and science and the secrets in the world. However, I loved human beings so much, and by the time that I had to make a career choice that I already had a encounter so many death in my friendship that kind of, you know, pulled me down and said, you know, I really need to connect with the human being. Maybe the medicine might be the cool combination of science and human nature. So I chose the medicine. That's why I'm here.
That's fantastic. You are truly a woman after my own heart. I think you know that I studied physics also, and I do believe that physics is the basis of all science, and then my mathematician friends tell me that mathematics is the basis of all physics. But I truly believe that physics has something to contribute to medicine, which is a combination of science and art, or let's say science with heuristics. But let's get back to Korea. It's a country that we hear a lot about, but I'm not sure that we know it so well. What was it like to grow up as a young woman with aspirations in Korea?
Well, so I think a lot of audience who may hear this show would know more about South Korea, about BTS. this is a country where we have a cool science, including Samsung, LG, Hyundai, and this oldest cool band where we have a oldest, like a really synchronized music and all. But the South Korea to me is a home country where I was born and grew up with. And then this is a home country of my mother where, you know, she has been the one of the most influential person that who kind of influenced me to become who I am today. And then kind of brought up to me, think about what's really the between men and women, what is there is difference between gender, what are the really cultural gap that we face when you're growing up in the very Asian, you know, type of country, including South Korea. So I think I could probably maybe start by talking a little bit about my mother, that she is basically a, so to speak, North Korean woman. You would probably know North Korea by name of Kim Jong-un, who's having all this like back and forth about missile and nuclear weapons with our own president for a long time. And, you know, she was a baby that she basically was in the blanket. Her family carried over down there where there was a huge civil war happening in the South and North Korea. And this was between the, you know, war between USSR and USA. And then when she came down to this southern part of the small city called Gwangju, basically her family was adopted to new life where all this different culture was mixed and everybody really had to figure out how they're going to survive and how they're going to find their own fortune. My mom's father, who was, you know, like my mom's side, grandfather, decided that he's going to try to import and do the business through the U.S. military. He was a very smart businessman, so he was making a lot of fortune. So she was one of the very wealthy students in the school that threw this business through her father, that she was one of the two girls who owned a wristwatch, believe it or not. So when she was getting this punishment as a representative of the class, that one of the teachers was trying to slap her wrist, and then her wristwatch like fell off, and it was a big news in the whole school. So that's how she brought up. And then when she was like 10 or 11, all of a sudden, she decided that she knows so much. You know, she've learned everything that she has supposed to, you know, about the world, and nothing else mattered. And she decided, oh, I know everything, so I'm going to just quit school and I'm just going to go on my own life. And she decided that, you know, she's going to just figure things on her own. And then she was so happy. She would go to market with my grandma. My grandma would use her as a portable calculator. So when she was making a negotiation in the market, she would tell, oh, so you have to get this much of a discount if you wanted to get the 20% discount. You know, so that's how she was growing. And I think literally at this time, when she was seeing so much of poverty that was happening in South Korea at that time, post-war, and then my grandma would bring up all these people to her dinner party and just randomly hosting people and give out the free food and say, it's okay, we are same Korean people, you know, it's okay for you to come and join us for dinner. And then despite having all these great neighbors and the kind of spiritual things going on, I think my mom was always hungry for something, something bigger meaning. And then I think she ended up finding this Christianity, which kind of became a big part of her life. So she would walk like 3 hours to go to like neighboring church. Nobody asked her to do it. None of my family at that time was Christian or anything, although Christianity was a big thing in South Korea. So she ended up like becoming very like attached to God. And then finally she said, you know what? I think God is calling me. I think it's a time for me to go back to school and become a better person. So 3 years go by. All of a sudden she said, I'm going to go back to school. Of course, my grandma, grandpa was like, you know, thrilled. And really, unfortunately, after a year of her joining back to high school, my grandpa passed away. And then at the time in South Korea, if your father passed away, basically you're done. You know, your all the wealth, your reputation in the community, all of your siblings' life basically demolished. So she was left with nothing. And she turned herself into more into Christianity. And then she became a pastor in Presbyterian church. And she became this junior pastor. And she was trying to teach the God's love to all these people who were kind of lost. And in somehow really give her the meaning when she was really lost for her own self, as well as the mixture of her confusion around what's going on in this whole like modern world. And then, you know, when she was a junior pastor, I guess, you know, she was this bright, young-minded, like beautiful young pastor that every single person who was going to the church, gave me this announcement that I'm going to marry her, you know, so I think she had a lot of guys after her. In the end, interestingly, she decided to choose this young guy who was a PhD PharmD student who was, you know, suffering through, had only one clothes for winter, one clothes for summer, and said, if he has this true passion for the science and the devotion to the world, if I can turn myself into him and maybe I can save the world through him. So she ended up marrying my dad. And long story short, in the end, it really didn't turn out to be that love story that everybody was hoping to. And finally, after 41 or 42 years, I think, you know, finally counting, she's finally trying to come out of the house, you know, from my dad. So it really didn't turn out to that love story that everybody's hoping to. But that's the story that, you know, my mom goes.
That's pretty remarkable. And there are so many lessons in that story. You know, we learn about what it's like for a family who's lost the father, the main person who brings in an income, being able to quit school when you're 10 and decide 3 years later you'll go back.
I know, right?
And what happens when you decide you'll devote your life to somebody else, and how that turns out. So what's the message you would most want us to take from that?
I mean, I think that really depends on the context, but when I look at my mom's life as a woman who, so my mom and I am like exactly 30 years apart. So I think when I became 30 was the first time I really felt like I lived half of what she lived so far. And there was the point that I really felt like I could really figure out what she had to go through. I think to me, all this mixture of this Asian culture and almost like a social environment that is forcing women to have embracing some of the certain moralities or the values, whether it's coming from the Christianity, whether it's coming from the Korean society, I was amazed to see that how this one brilliant young woman could really cocoon herself and cut her all, you know, own wings of the butterfly, which is beautiful, into herself, into Titan self. So to me, it was kind of a lesson that we could probably improve and really try to, you know, put a very like different perspective, trying to not to be swayed by what your society really tries to tell you. I guess that was my take on.
So, you know, I think as women, we grow up with this idea when maybe we don't necessarily have it when we're younger, but when we get married, that we're there to make everything happen for everybody else, for the husband, for the children, and we lose ourselves sometimes. And maybe that's not a good thing.
Yeah, definitely.
So I do want to say that I was once described as a rescue ranger myself.
Wonderful.
That was in some therapy negotiations while I was getting married to my second husband, and he had two children, and they were like, well, here comes rescue ranger Mary, and I thought, huh. But that didn't end so well for me.
Maybe it's the name, Mary.
You know, I have often thought that my grandmother Mary had a bad marriage. My cousin Mary had bad marriages. I've had bad marriages. And now I shudder to think that I named my oldest daughter Alexandra Maria. But I'm hoping that the translation to Maria is going to break the spell.
I have no doubt.
So where did this background of your mother's devotion to saving someone, along with your interest in science, take you in your relationships?
I guess that's very interesting. So when I saw my mom, I think I have this faint memory that I think I was probably 5 or 6 that I looked at my mom. It was one of those days that my dad would abuse her verbally. He never hit her. He hit us, but he never hit her, like put her hands on her. But he would verbally abuse her to the point that she was just like sitting in the corner, very sad, crying. And let me think that, oh my God, I could just leave this house. But if I leave this house, like she would be so sad or brokenhearted because she lost her child. So I still have that really faint memory as a very young child. And then I think that kind of engraved me in some way. And then I know that a lot of the smart people tell me, oh, your parents, you know, bad marriage doesn't mean that you have to be in the same way. But I think I always kind of took it on that and thinking, no matter who I meet, it's never going to be lasting relationship. So I could really care less of who I was in with. And when I went to this exciting science high school that, you know, I entered and I met this like perfect boy who was tall, handsome, beautiful, good at sports, who was so smart, like who could pick up anything and do everything he wanted. And then, you know, but he was also in other perspective of society was a loser, that his mom killed herself when he was 11, and his father turned into alcoholic afterwards, and he had this brother who was unclear mother of origin, who was 10 years younger than him. And then I really felt like it didn't really matter for me that who I was with, but this was the guy that who has perfect profile that I could just care less and have love at the moment, and then I could just chuck him away if I really didn't need him. So I was with him for 9 years, believe it or not. He was my first love. We did everything together. There was a lot of first moments with him. And then we were, you know, just the first thing for everything. But I think for me, it came really easy despite me having to pay his phone bill and rent sometimes and feed him in the every evening, that I just knew that there was the end of it, you know. So when he told me that when I was, you know, finally deciding to leave the country, that I really thought they were going to get married, I had to tell him that, you know, that was it. And my friend thought that he was going to die after I left him, but he survived. And he now has two beautiful kids. And he told me about 2 years ago that finally he found out what was wrong with him when we were dating. And he's on a therapy to get it over with. So there was some happy ending.
Yeah, although there's nothing like fixing the guy for the next woman.
Yeah, I'm sure the current wife is very happy about that.
Much so. Yes, I have to say I had that same attitude that I had my own education, had my own income, and I didn't need somebody to support me, so I didn't mind supporting somebody else as long as they loved me and entertained me. And it actually didn't go down very well. There were a lot of other feelings that come about. So I just want to, since you talked about having been with him for, what, 9 years?
Mm-hmm.
And you let go.
Yes, that's right.
And he let go, and y'all were both okay after that.
I called him in the international calling, you know, even after 2 years when I was really drunk. But, you know, other than that, I let him go.
So I letting go is such a big step. I really want to play for you a story from one of our previous shows about letting go. And that's Harwood Taylor, who's a storyteller here in Houston and has been a guest host here, telling us this story so well. So, Tatiana, can you put that on?
I'm sitting at dinner with my girlfriend. It's the first night of what I had planned to be a 5-night romantic beachside resort vacation. And we're having dinner with this couple that's been together for 30 years. And they have this incredible gentle quality connection. And being with them just emphasized the fact that I did not have that with the woman that I was with Priscilla. Well, it made a lot of sense. I mean, we were in our late 20s, and these people had been married longer than we had been alive, so they had a lot on us. And somehow in my infinite wisdom, I thought that it would be a great idea to bring up the fact that I had this thought that we didn't have this great connection that this couple that we were seated next to at dinner had. Let me describe this place. So this is 1992. We are literally 30 feet off a beach. There were just thatched huts and a thatched, larger thatched dining room that had cotton window coverings, if you will, and they were rolled up and they were tied with mangroves. I mean, it was real earthy. There was no fax machine, no telephones. It was just, there was a full moon that night. Anyway, so we're in our little thatched hut, and I said, you know, that couple had something really special, and she goes, yeah, and by the way, I didn't want to break up or anything. I just thought it might deepen our relationship to bring this up. It didn't. She said, you know what? I've been thinking about the same thing. I think we should break up. Boom. Done. She's done. And I said, well, that's not really what I had in mind. She goes, no, really, I've been thinking about this for a few weeks, and I know, you know, it's weird timing, but, and I'm like, you got to be kidding me. This is the first night of a five, you know, romantic nights together. I mean, we're on the beach, you know, so no romance. She goes, no romance. I said, no snuggling, no snuggling, she says. I said, spooning, and no, no spoons. So the next morning we get up and we have breakfast with these superhero lesbians. Now, I describe them as superheroes because they told me casually about this freshwater jungle river that was Disneyland-like, they described. But, you know, a little bit hairy to get to, but once you got there, you know, could float down this freshwater jungle river. Well, Priscilla wanted to read a book. My heart was broken, even though I probably knew it was the right thing. And so I took off with this really beautiful, expensive camera that I kept with me everywhere. And I found the mouth of the jungle that they described. And I was to walk a couple of miles into the jungle. This was a real jungle. It wasn't Disneyland. I mean, I felt like Indiana Jones, and I wasn't with my girlfriend or anybody else. I was alone. And I mean, I'm a city boy, so this was scary. It was a bright day outside. And when I entered the jungle, there were just little shafts of light that would come down every once in a while, and sounds and smells I'd never seen before. And they told me that you're going to see a very small opening to this river, and that's where you go in. It's going to look like that's not where you go in, but that's where you go in. And 2 miles in, I found this little glint of light coming off water. I could hear the water, and I made my way without a machete somehow over to the water, and I thought, there's no way I'm getting in that. I mean, it looked like the kind of thing that would be alligator infested. But I had been listening to Joseph Campbell at the time, and, you know, he was talking about, you know, that all of our lives are hero's journeys. And I was like, this is going to be my hero's journey. I'm going to do this. I'm going to jump into this water. I had set my camera down, by the way, on the beach, and I was going to float back out. The river floated back out to the beach, and then, you know, I'd walk down and get my camera. Anyway, so I could tell that there was nothing underneath where I was. The water had eroded underneath me. And I put on my mask, and I wanted to make sure there wasn't a monster like right underneath where I was getting to the water that was just going to eat me right away. And so I stuck my head in the water, like, so now I'm upside down looking underneath me, and 20 feet back and 20 feet down, there's nothing. It's just a mangrove field I'm walking on. It was just amazing. No monsters, but this incredibly beautiful network of vines, like fingers reaching down into the water. It was like an upside down underwater cathedral. And I started to pull myself in. I was like, I'm seduced by visual things, and I loved it. And I pulled myself a little further, and I got waist deep, and I started to feel my shoulders being pulled by the current. And I just said, you just need to keep pushing, just push. I pushed one last time. Now I'm in the river and I'm floating down, and I'm freaking out because now I can't get out. And I'm swiveling underwater with the mask on, looking for that gator because I know he's there. And then I pop my head up and I'm floating down this river, and I'm swiveling my head and I'm looking for that gator because it's going to eat me, right? And I just, my, you know, heart is beating out of my chest, and I just finally just tell myself, okay, a gator might get me. And you know what? I'm going to miss this whole damn thing if I don't chill out. And I literally made peace with, I'm going to be eaten, and this is going to be the last thing I do. And this is incredibly beautiful. And I just exhaled and I started to float down this incredibly gorgeous freshwater jungle river. I saw every kind of flower you can imagine, the scents, the sounds, little shafts of light that would go down and cut through the water and into that network of vines that went down into the water, floated all the way out. I started to hear the ocean. It was the singular most beautiful nature experience I've ever had. Started to see the blue sky break through, heard the ocean, the river met the ocean, got out, started up the trail back to where Priscilla was, mm-hmm. Picked up my camera. And when I got close enough to see Priscilla, I had a long zoom lens on it. And I picked up my zoom lens and I focused it on her. And she was so beautiful. She was sitting on this log. And she had this long ringlet hair that was blowing sideways and a long scarf that was blowing. She had never looked that beautiful before. And as I focused in, I also had to acknowledge I really wasn't in love with her. And I took a picture and I let her go.
Wow. Wow.
So I think Harwood uses the turbulence of the water and the fear of the alligators as a metaphor for the confusion and fears that come with letting go. And for you, you had been with this young man for something like 9 years, mm-hmm. and you're not only leaving him, but that's when you decided to come to the United States, a whole nother country. Mm-hmm. Talk about alligators.
Yeah. Actually, so it was very interesting transition for me that I came to this country, and then when I was young, like, I was always this popular standing up comedian and politician. And then I came to this country and I almost like lost my tongue because it was my native language. I never had an experience with the English speaking. And so I was sitting there in the resident lounge looking around and just smiling and not understanding of half of what they were saying. And so that actually helped me not to have to think about him. But when I actually go and get the deep unconscious drinking mode, then that's when,
that's when things are
turning. Yeah. And then you're always trying to go back to the salmon instinct to go back to alligator.
Yes, yes, yes. I didn't let you go. Priscilla, come back.
That's right. Through the lens.
Yes, through the lens. Okay, we want to hear more about what happens to you after you started your medical school training in the United States in just a moment, but we're going to break for station identification now. We are here on KPFT, 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville, or live streaming from kpft.org, and I like to say anywhere in the ether. Our show is So What's Your Story? And I am proud to say that we can now refer to So What's Your Story? As an award-winning program thanks to the Storytelling Trailblazer Award, given to Dr. Hank at the Texas Storytelling Festival in Denton this past weekend.
Woohoo!
Yeah! Hank and Warren tell us that the pressure is on because we are becoming a tad famous. Congrats, Dr. Hank, and congratulations to us all. Our award-winning show is broadcast live every Thursday at 8 p.m.
Well, congratulations to Dr. Hank, who's sitting right next to me here. It's really exciting to be part of a team like this. And let me update our audience on our social media outlets so they can join in on our excitement, because you, the audience, are what makes this special. If you don't have a radio, it's no excuse for missing it, because you can listen to us stream live on kpft.org and on our Facebook Live on our So What's Your Story Facebook page. Please be sure to share our page with your friends, and oh yes, we'd love it if you'd like us when you leave. We also post on YouTube. Check out our program clips there. And we have added another way for you to contact us about our show, either by leaving a post on our So What's Your Story Facebook page, or you can contact anyone on the So What's Your Story team with questions and about ideas for programs at sowhatsyourstory@kpft.org. We promise to get back to you. And tell us what you think about our shows or suggest program ideas.
So, and that exact email address is story@kpft.org. We didn't want to have to make you type. So what's your story? Every time I type it out, it's like, whoa! Yeah, so it's story@kpft.org. So, thank you, Hank, and thank you, KPFT, for setting that up. And to our listeners, we would love to hear from you. We look forward to our weekly show and the opportunity to be an important part of the Houston storytelling scene. We are the only live radio storytelling show and an award-winning radio storytelling show to boot here in Houston. Tatiana, what other storytelling venues are there to announce here in our great metropolis?
Well, we can start with the Houston Storytellers Guild. Join them because this is the best group to work with to start cultivating your storytelling talent. Just get to their monthly story swaps held on the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emanuel at 1500 Sunset. You can go to their website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for upcoming events and all of our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008 listed on the menu under radio program.
Oh, yes, and I love that tab. I just want to emphasize that, yes, you can listen to our old shows over and over again. And I love doing that in the evening as I'm winding down. Got my glass of wine. Got my computer open. Do that Google on Houston Storytellers. Hit that radio button. And then I just scroll down. Sometimes I don't know what it is. I don't remember what the theme was. And sometimes it's an old favorite. Sorry to interrupt, but I do love listening to the oldies but goodies. So please continue, Tatiana.
And you can't miss our friends at The Moth at Warehouse Live. Usually it is on the second Tuesday of every month, but this month it will be this coming Tuesday, the third Tuesday of the month, so March 19th. The theme is going to be magic, so go for it, storytellers.
Hey, and I just want to take a moment before we go back to our storytelling to get Hank to pitch in here and tell us a little bit about what happened this weekend and what it felt like to get the award.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Well, thanks, Mary. I appreciate it. And you know what? All these accolades are not really, well, yeah, sure they're warranted. What am I thinking?
Of course
warranted. I know. I'm just kidding. You guys, it was, as I said earlier, this really is an award for the group. It is. This is an award for the team. And as I had mentioned before the show, so many people at Tejas had listened to our show earlier. The Texas Storytelling Association is really a pretty marvelous one. I was so impressed with the stellar storytellers that were there and some of national recognition. And, you know, the award that we received, and I do want to say we, is for the Trailblazer Award. We were the first storytelling radio show in town and in the state, in the entire state. We were here before The Moth, before Dinosaurs. We've been around a long time. And I'm just so
okay,
proud.
Hank, I wasn't here before Dinosaurs. You might have been, not me, okay?
Yeah, I was. I was so old that when I was in school, there was no history. I mean, that's pretty old,
I mean, I
right?
might have been yeah, here I before batteries, when the toys
yeah,
were all wind
batteries.
Up. But I'm not going to say Dinosaurs.
I know. We're old. I'm old. I like it. I like it that way. It's been around a while. But I'll tell you, our show really does rock, and I've always thought it did, but there was a whole lot of reinforcement this last weekend, and Warren and I were just thrilled. We were just totally thrilled, and as I told everyone, we plan on being around a really, really long time. So thank you, Mary, and thank you, Warren, and Greg, and Tatiana, and Dr. Bora, all of you, and all of the guests, and our guest hosts for all of these years. We've been around since 2008, technically, and I just want to say that it's never too late to live happily ever after. That's the way I ended my acceptance speech on Saturday. And it is the way we end every show. And I cannot think of a statement that is more applicable. So thank you, Mary, for the time.
Oh, that's wonderful. So to our radio audience, I am here with Dr. Bora Lim, one of my colleagues at MD Anderson. And she's telling us about her life and especially her progress in achieving her dreams, and we're celebrating that as a part of Women's Month. Now, Bora, just before the break, we were talking about your decision to come to the U.S. for a medical training program, and of course, we likened a little bit of that to being eaten by alligators.
Of course.
So where did you land?
So I landed in Pennsylvania Hospital, the nation's first of United States of 1579 or 1572 in Philadelphia, is a part of the University of Pennsylvania Hospital Program.
Oh, you know, so I, a little bit before you, did my residency at the University of Pennsylvania, and I actually had both of my children at Pennsylvania Hospital.
Wow.
It's so beautiful, so beautiful.
Wow.
I was there on bed rest for one of my pregnancies for a child who's now graduated with a degree in mechanical engineering, so it ended up fine. But I do remember that November morning when I woke up and it had snowed. And if you ever go to Philadelphia, go see this hospital. There are historic buildings all around it that date back to Benjamin Franklin's time.
That's right.
And they were just covered in a dusting of snow. It was absolutely beautiful. I wonder, could you share us a story from your residency?
So there are a few stories that we could share probably, and we could start by oldest Benjamin Franklin, oldest wonderful surgical amphitheater. There was a tuberculosis floor that turned into this resident lounge where we used to host a monthly resident gathering. Like, we used to get a check from each faculty and say, can you please donate your money to host this, like, monthly celebration between faculty and the residents?
In the old TB lounge.
That's right, in the old TB lounge. And usually we start with some kind of really light beers and PIMS, and, you know, because we did have some graduates from UK. I'm sure you know more about that as a Marshall Fellow. And then we ended up in the somebody standing and dancing on the, you know, top of the TV floor table. And then I was usually one of them, and it became a social chair. And that's how I became a chair, I think. But, you know, that story, so initially it was starting as a something that I just landed there out of nowhere, and my first goal was really trying to get over my life by, you know, doing more parties and forget about things, but ended up being in a very, like, a, you know, the next love story of my life that maybe made me realize that what my father was and, you know, my mom was suffering from, and very interesting love story part of my life.
Are you going to tell us about that one?
Okay. So... yeah, I mean, this is sort of recent. So you heard about my 9 years long history of this dating with one person. After that, I think I was more like a serial monogamy. I was very quick to change. So if one guy doesn't work out, I would just quickly move on to next train. And then, you know, saying goodbye. And everybody thought that I was some kind of guy that maybe come out with the XYX gene or something.
It's called a playoff.
We're just very sincere monogamy who didn't believe in long-term relationship. And then when I became 30, I met a guy that who was kind of dreamy, easy on the eyes, MD, PhD, very smart, you know, like, I used to be a model in New York and had everything that he could have. And, you know, like, he had this gorgeous girlfriend at the time when we first met, but everybody sort of thought that we were a good match. And then even before he kind of finished his previous relationship, somehow we were together. And then they went on for dragging on and off for 4.5 years afterwards. And this was some guy that I never experienced before. Older guys I've dated were somewhat defective, you know, of course, including myself.
defective, I like that.
Well, every human beings are defective, including myself.
Right, right.
But they were very easy to get along, very nice people. Even if we have to break up, it was very easy as a human being. It was very with the dignity. But with this guy, every single step of the way was very difficult. I had a really, like, heartbreaking, sore, like, every step of the things, every single date and every single event. And then I really thought that maybe that's because this guy is supposed to be my soulmate, you know? Something's different with this guy, that this, maybe it's his Belgian good looks, or is it something, the Belgian beer or something? But then, actually, when I was doing my fellowship, that's when everything really hit me, that there was something drastically wrong with this relationship. And I was suffering so much to the point that I actually literally called out every single friend that I had in my phone book, which never happened in my life. And every single friend that I had was worried about me, because, you know, it never happened to me. I was always that strong Bora that who didn't care less and who could just go and pick up the guys, like, left and right. So they said, it's about time for you to go into the shrink. And I said, well, what are you going to tell me? They're going to tell me the same thing I know. I said, no, you really have to go and sit down with somebody who knows what they're talking about. So I ended up go see a shrink. And she told me very normal things that, you know, everybody would tell you. Oh, so hematology oncology fellowship's difficult. My father, you know, everybody go through that. But literally, I think she was trying to give me a subliminal message for 2 years that this guy was a narcissist. And finally, I realized on my own through that experience that he was a narcissist, which I didn't really know much about. And more importantly, through that experience, I learned what was wrong with my father, who was a very closeted narcissist. Very smart, very nice man from outside. So many friends. Everybody thought that he was the nicest guy in the room. But in the end, he was very abusing the, you know, most closest people. And then I became a survivor. And now if somebody comes to me and then if they have any small red flag being a narcissist, sorry, sir, this is not for you. So that's how I got to learn about my dad. And after that, I really tried to really support my mom, not in the way that I thought it was right, but in the way that she really could, you know, devote for her own self.
That's a true woman's story, and a lot of us, myself included, get caught up in somebody else's life and in seeing ourselves as the person who's the wrong person, the one who made the mistake, the one who needs to fix myself, because obviously that person, you know, is just fine. It's me who's the problem. And that doesn't go so well. I want to put something up in contrast that we can listen to. This is a woman, I believe, Hank, that you hosted her, and she had a very good relationship with her father, a very strong one. And I just want to put that up to contrast against relationships you've had, relationships I've had, and how the model could be different. So, Tatiana, can you pull that up for us?
So one of the people that he worked with up in Fairbanks was a clown whose name was Hippie, and that was his last name was Hip, and so they called him Hippie for short. And, you know, he used to walk around Alaskaland. He kind of, his job was to run people up and down in a hot air balloon, and he chased a wild pig, and he had a shotgun, and if they needed to get more people over to the ice cream stand.
My dad was professionally ambidextrous.
Yeah.
A lot of things.
After a while, Hippie, after he left Alaskaland, he moved down to Florida and became a clown with the Ringling Brothers Circus. And in 1974, my family and I were attending the Ringling Brothers Circus at Madison Square Gardens in New York City. And we're sitting in our seats, and all of a sudden this clown on stilts comes walking out, and my dad yells, "Look, there's Hippie!" So the circus hadn't started yet, so Dad ran down, and you could hear him going, "Hippie, Hippie," and Hippie walks over on the stilts and leans over, and the two of them are conversing for a couple of minutes, and then Hippie walks off, and Dad comes back up to the seats, and he says, "We're getting together with Hippie after the circus, and we're going to have dinner." So after the circus was all over, we went down to the ring, and Hippie came and picked us up and took us on a tour through the circus boxcars. And I tell you, I don't know if you ever saw the HBO special Carnival, or it was kind of like a David Lynch movie, you know, the bearded lady and the jugglers and all that stuff were all taking their makeup off, and we got to meet everyone. And then afterwards, we went out to dinner with Hippie and the two circus midgets. And they hadn't fully redressed. The circuit midgets were in their little circus outfits, and Hippie was in his clown outfit with his little bow tie on. So we went up the street to a typical New York restaurant. It was a little taverna, and it was very small. And we walked in, and we said, you know, there's seven of us for dinner. And the maitre d' looks over at the two midgets and the clown and says, "I'm sorry, but the gentlemen will have to wear dinner jackets." And my dad, having been through this circus before, said to the waiter, to the maitre d', "Do you have any jackets in the back?" And the waiter says, "Let me check." And so he comes out with three jackets. And, of course, here's these two midgets with full men's jackets on. And we all go and we sit down, and the waitress comes up, and she says, "Can I take your order?" And one of the midgets turns to her and he says, "Yes, my friend and I would like a martini and the child's plate."
Okay, we're sitting back here laughing. Sorry about that. That took us by surprise. But that story was told by Stefanie Twyford, and it was about her father, who was a famous photographer. His name was Martin Elcourt, and he passed away about a year and a half ago. And I think what we hear in that story is this joy in retelling a story about her parent, and the joy lives on in the retelling of it over and over again. And you spoke a little bit about your father and mother's difficult time. So what does Stefanie's story mean to you when you hear that?
So I guess the love, you know, so like the reason I kind of stay as a Christian despite all the scarring that my family may have caused is because I really believe that still I would love to love your neighbors. So I think this story tells you that you can all love your neighbors, and I love all of my neighbors, including all of you in the room. But still, I think it would be really so great that if you could truly love you despite what situations such as that you have to find the big Donald Duck's shoes in that situation in the swimming pool of the have to put out that sparkly jacket for two midgets. So I think that is like, to me, that is the ultimate love that some lucky people have, and maybe we can still continue to longing for. Or maybe that's the human networking and the love that we could just share as a community.
I think that's beautiful. I think we can share a lot of kinds of love as a community. And I have to say, having been through two failed marriages, but in a current state of really enjoying like and enjoying my career and who I am as a pathologist, and Bora and I actually work together and
That's
talk
right.
about things that we might actually do together and things of interest. So I feel I've achieved quite a bit as a person through all this. But going back to parent-child relationships, you know, one of the things that's been difficult for me, but then in the end has helped me, is my own relationship with my daughters. Mm-hmm. And of course it was, oh my God, so difficult when they were 15. You're the worst mother ever. Don't cry those crocodile tears. Anyway, and now what I've learned is that to let them go and be adults on their own and not put a constraint around them of what they have to be because of who I am or because of what society is, but to allow them to be what they want to be, has made us so close. Now, I'm bringing this around back to the parent-child relationship, because I think you did tell me a story from your residency about a discovery about a parent-child relationship that you had while you were taking care of a sick patient.
Yeah, I mean, so one of the things that I really am very happy about making a decision to come to medicine instead of physics is that, you know, I just learned so much about every single encounter that I have with one of my, you know, many wonderful patients. But one of the stories that really sticks to my head is when I was a senior resident, I had this wonderful woman who was very quiet, you know, single, was taking care of herself all this year, who's mid-50s, and who came to us with a really protruding chest wall mass. She had a auto-amputated breast, meaning that her cancer was so bad to the point that both breasts fell off with the cancer. And she had this giant mass, it was almost like alien, if you have seen that movie, coming out of the chest. And, you know, she was basically dying. And then as a senior resident, my job was to go into her and talk to her about, okay, this might be the next line of therapy, that it may not work for you, but we could try this. But realistically, you're dying, and, you know, we really don't think that if you're coding, we don't want to pump your chest. And you need to convince the patient, say that, yes, I agree that, doctor, I don't think that that really matters for me. And then literally I was so worried that if I pump her chest, then my chest, my head, you know, hands will literally pull through her cancer and then just grab her heart. And then she told me initially that she needs to wait until August because her life insurance doesn't kick in August, which I didn't think that was making any sense. But then later she really told me that the reason why she could not really die until August 3rd was because two of her sons, beloved son, for some reason got apart and didn't talk to each other for 10 years. And they're supposed to come back on August 3rd. And there was supposed to be their family reunion. And so ever since they, and of course she didn't make that long. She died in the middle of July. You know, so, and then I never got to meet the sons. I don't know what happened to them. But that was the first time I realized that if I save one person with the breast cancer, instead of maybe tying up one person, maybe I could really connect the East to West. And maybe I'm really saving the whole community that of the lost connection between families. And if I don't have that personally, maybe I can really save many women, and maybe I can recreate that by treating this whole society as a disease. So I think that's the main reason why I'm devoting myself into this aggressive breast cancer, where I could probably learn that from every single patient in everyday life.
So give me a moment while I wipe the tears away. And I want to say, because I, as a pathologist, went through historical records at MD Anderson looking at young women aged 20 to 35 with breast cancer and what I called postmenopausal women post age 60, but which my fellow who was working with me called, quote, the old ladies. And I kept trying to say, I think I'm one of the old ladies. Be careful what you say. But anyway, the aggressive cancers are literally 2 to 3 times as common in the younger women as they are in the postmenopausal women, not the old ladies. And it's really something. Every so often I have a day where I say, oh, 32, oh, 28, oh, 35. You just have to take a break, and it makes you realize how lucky, makes me realize how lucky I am, you know, to have my health, my children's health.
Yeah. We're 23 who came out of the party by an ambulance and never made it out of the hospital.
Yeah. Anyway, we've gone through a lot of stories here. There have been a lot of great stories. There have been stories, it's like the butterfly emerging from the cocoon over and over again.
And, that's right.
And as women, we continually metamorphosize. As women, we continually empower ourselves. And at one point in my life, I think I was about 21 or 22, and I'd had a relationship with this man. I was in England, and he was going back to Italy. And, you know, in the throes of the positive parts of the relationship, we talked about staying together forever. And then he got up to go and said, well, I'm leaving now. And I said to some friends of ours that we shared in common, I said, this actually sounds kind of romantic looking back on it, I'm going to give him to Paris. It's going to take him 2 days to get to Paris, and then it would take him 2 days to get back to me. And after 4 days, I'm going to let him go. Well, 4 days passed, and he wasn't back at my doorstep. And so I was on their doorstep in tears, you know, drinking wine, needing to be comforted. And it so happened that my friend and his wife were both poets, actually, and they were in England in 1976 for a bicentennial poet exchange. So I'm still in mourning, and the next day I'm having coffee with Jim Heinen and the poet husband side of them, and he says, I wrote a poem for you. And you said, I was like, you did? And he said, yeah, you know, I was thinking about how you felt about, you know, your breakup and everything, and I wrote this poem for you. Now, I think I was expecting something like a Shakespeare sonnet.
How romantic.
That's not what it was, but I'm going to read it to you because it actually is quite uplifting in its own way. And the name of the poem is Falling Out of Love. Let it be like balding, not the daily loss that seems to be everywhere, clogging your drain, sticking to your comb or toothbrush, staying in bed with your pillow while you rise less whole to confront the growing absence. Let it be like balding, like the moon rising through the forest, a slow ascent into the night. You feel yourself alone and whole, declaring a crisp October sky. And that's what it is. In fact, I've told my children that if ever I get a tattoo, and I haven't ruled it out entirely yet, it's going to be a phoenix.
Oh.
I will constantly arise again.
A crisp October sky.
Yes, yes. Hank, you mentioned having a poem that you think fits in with this sentiment of our self-empowerment. We women as the phoenix, constantly coming out of the ashes and remaking ourselves.
Yeah, well, this is a poem, and thanks for the opportunity. This is a poem. It's called Another Day, and I wrote this when I was a senior in college, and senior in high school, excuse me. And it was about a mythical girl, because, you know, I'm a senior in high school, right? And don't even ask me what ignited
this. What was that called, science project?
It was just called daydreaming. But it was a very serious poem, actually, and a lot of people liked it. I cleaned it up a little bit, and it was published somewhere. God knows where. I don't even know. But here's the interesting thing, a real quick story. It's a mythical woman, but it's a woman that I met when I was 57 years old, and that is Peggy. All of you know her. She's my wife. And really, really the love of my life, genuinely. And that's this is what it who it fits. We followed each other to a place we'd never been before and fell to the ground that was so easily a memory. Lips molded to one eternal kiss, our minds tucked peacefully into each other's. We spoke truths. You admitted to having missed me. We loved for the world and another day. And I think that is that's a message about womanhood. It's about what women do. Beautiful, beautiful things. And that's what Peggy did for me. And I appreciate the opportunity to share it. So take that, Bora. You said I'm not into poetry. Take that. Just letting you know. Thank you.
Thank you. I could write a poem in Korean, not in English yet.
We'll be working on that. We'll be working on that.
Lovely poem.
Do you want to say goodnight to anybody in Radioland here tonight?
Yeah, sure. So first of all, I would like to thank Hank, Tatiana, Mary for this wonderful opportunity. And I just was so excited about this opportunity. I kind of shared a little bit with my patient, so there might be some of my patients listening to this. As a single woman, my patients are my children. So I'll say good night, my children. I love you always. And thank you for bringing me back to where I'm supposed to be. And no matter what happens in the hardship that happens in the world, I always am here trying to be strong because of you and every single moment because of you. Thank you. Good night.
So beautiful. Oh, don't you dare move out there, because Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on the Tennyson tapes. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Mary E., and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Decided to donate your birthday to KPFT this year. Thank you. If your special day hasn't yet arrived, consider donating your birthday to KPFT. Here's how it works. Facebook sends you a prompt before your birthday asking if you'd like to donate your birthday to a nonprofit. Select KPFT as your organization of choice. Then add a personalized message so that your friends know how much KPFT means to you. On your birthday, they'll receive a Facebook notification asking them to make a donation in your honor to KPFT. Thanks again for supporting 90.1 FM KPFT Houston, Pacifica Radio for Peace.